We're going to keep looking at Matt Dillahunty's critique of the minimal facts put forth by Gary Habermas and talk about why historians don't speculate. This is Matthew Garnett. Welcome to In Layman's Terms.
But what I do acknowledge is that we know that people come near death. We don't have good reason to think that people can come back from death. And so when we talk about which one is more likely given the available evidence, then I would have to say that the swoon theory at least seems plausible, whereas the model under which Jesus is the Son of God who is died and resurrected by God is something that is wholly outside of experience.
I am a bit of a historian myself, in a manner of speaking. My focus at Claremont School of Theology, the master's degree I was seeking, was in ancient Christian literature. And so the study of ancient Christian literature was a bit of a hybrid type of major for a master's degree, which was higher criticism, some lower criticism, mixed with some historiography. And so I learned some of those techniques while I was there. And one thing that we tried to resist, especially when it came to historical data, was speculation. And that's going to kind of be the name of the game as we finish out going over Matt Dillahunty's critique of Gary Habermas's minimal facts approach to apologetics and the resurrection. But before we get to all that, let me remind you to listen to us on KNNA The Cross. They've got an app, and we are on their radio frequency all the time. It's kind of cool to be on a radio station that's broadcast over the air. I like that idea. So if you are in that area, tune us in on KNNA The Cross. You can also, again, download their app and listen to all their content. They've got a bunch of great programming there I would encourage you to listen to. Also, don't forget to donate your $50 to the Kenya Well Project. We are going to, at some point, be bringing in the Kenyan arts and melding that with our fundraising efforts for the Kenya Well Project. Let me remind you of Derek and Catherine, and to go check out their stories at laymanstermsradio.org. Catherine told us last time about how the days where she has to go to the stream and carry water are very laborious, and she's worried about the safety of the water and these sorts of things. And this is something the children shouldn't have to worry about. I mean, just something as simple as getting fresh water should not be something children should have to worry about. They should be able to get fresh water and get their education and not have that be part of their day. It's difficult enough in Kenya. So let's give our $50. Let's get this well drilled. We're moving along with this. We've raised a good portion of money, but we need to pick up the pace, people. We really do. It's going to take us forever to get this raised if we're going to continue at the pace we're at. So we need to pick up the pace. Just bite the bullet. Give your $50. Have it over with. And then we can all celebrate when we get this well drilled. And it's just going to make such a huge difference in these children's lives. Like I've talked about before, it's going to knock down that domino. It's going to knock down all dominoes. So please donate your $50 to the Kenya Well Project. Okay, so we're going to go over this critique Matt Dillahunty has put forth on Gary Habermas's minimal facts. Again, this is my primary go-to apologetically. So I thought, oh, well, here's an atheist addressing this, which I've never heard before, which is a plus. It's good to hear an atheist address one of the best arguments, I would argue the best argument put forth in apologetics. But unfortunately, I was sorely disappointed that he actually didn't address it at all. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So without further ado, without further gilding the lily, here we go with Matt Dillahunty's critique of Gary Habermas's minimal facts.
So most of the time when you hear the minimal facts approach, it's presented with respect to the resurrection of Jesus, the biblical story. And this is where Habermas and Lacona, you know, kind of formulated this. They used it in their book. There have been a lot of debates along these lines. But
By the way, most of the time when you hear the minimal facts approach, it's associated with the resurrection. There's a theme that lies throughout this critique that Dillahunty presents. And the theme is this. I'm not sure that I have a question as to whether or not he knows what the minimal facts is really focused in on. There's no question it's focused in on the resurrection. But he says a couple of things that are weird like this that makes me think that he just heard this. There's a minimal facts theory out there to prove Christianity. And he just basically, I suspect this. I can't prove this. It's not fair to say that this is where he's coming from. But he just says weird stuff like this in this critique to make me think that he read a book by its cover and he heard minimal facts to prove Christianity and he ran with it. Basically, not really knowing what the arguments were, because some of this stuff I just can't track with. You'll see what I'm talking about as we go on.
Get back to what's wrong with the method, but I want to talk a little bit about how the method's being used and why that's even worse. You see, if you have someone who's a scholar, who is investigating the facts, who has studied things in great detail, as Habermas has clearly done, then the method may have its flaws, but those flaws can be pointed out, and hopefully we can move on. But the way the method's being used is to feed the average Christian in the pew something to memorize. I've found, for example, more than one website advocating, hey, this is what you need to know in order to defend the resurrection. One of the websites suggested that they memorize this, and they wanted to give a justification for why you should memorize this. Number one, to give you rational assurance that Christianity is true when you face various doubts. This gets back to the doubt issue that I was just talking about. And what they're essentially saying is, whenever you face doubts, don't bother actually investigating. Somebody else has already done that for you. Just go back to what you memorized, and it will give you a rational assurance that will get rid of your doubts.
Okay, so that's not really... So this is something... The minimal facts is something I teach to my teenage children in my Bible class. I don't simply stand up there in front of the class and say, class, memorize these things, and then don't worry about investigating any further. That's not what I say. There may be some people out there, like this website he's citing, because I really don't know that much about it. He doesn't give the URL for the website, so I could go check it out. He just says that this website says, just memorize this and you'll be good. It might very well say that. There's some really crappy websites out there that propose stuff like this. This is not what I teach my teenage children. We study this in depth every Sunday and go through the details of it, so they have understanding. If there's a crappy website out there that's saying, hey, just memorize this stuff and you're good to defend Christianity, well, of course, that's silly.
Number two, to prepare you conversationally to explain why you're a Christian when others ask honest questions about beliefs. Problem is, memorization isn't understanding. It doesn't prepare you for anything. And when you come up against somebody who actually understands this, you're going to be in big trouble. Your memorization, your script, is what many of us have been countering for years. When somebody comes to my door to sell their particular brand of a religion, they are almost always operating off a script. We have had, you know, ministers and apologists teach the congregation, this is what you need to say. And when they say this, you say this. A lot of us are done going anywhere near your script, and we're going to ask the questions that throw you off. And some of us have an understanding of the subjects that go well beyond what the average parishioner's understanding is in the script that you're using. Teaching them to memorize this, even if it were a valid, even if it were a sound way to go about evaluating the question, I think would be a mistake, because you're not encouraging understanding. The third reason to memorize it, to have a better grasp on the historical facts surrounding the life of Jesus. The problem is, memorizing doesn't give you an understanding, and the list of things they want to memorize don't give you any real historical facts and no way to actually justify and support them. To tell somebody that memorizing this list is going to give you a better grasp on the historical facts is just absurd. Look at the five things that they want you to memorize, the five facts.
Okay, so this is... Dilly Honey has a point here in the sense of just memorizing the minimal facts. And just for review, let's go through them. First fact. Jesus was an historical figure who was crucified by the Roman government. Second fact. Jesus' followers had experiences with him after he died. Third fact. St. James, a skeptic, had experiences with Jesus after he died. Fourth fact. St. Paul, a persecutor of the church, had experiences with Jesus after he died. Fifth fact. The church was launched based on the resurrection. Sixth fact. The testimony of the resurrection is early. Those are the six facts. Now, we want to understand what's behind these facts. Just me giving you those facts. And by the way, let me add two things. Habermas, in his research for his PhD and in subsequent and subsequently in sharpening that research as the years have gone by, identifies that those six facts, 95% of all scholars that he surveyed, including his pool includes mostly skeptical scholars, agree to those six facts, 95%. The other issue is that there are 10 independent attestations to those facts. Does it include Holy Scripture? Yes, it does. But to ignore Scripture as a source for history, any historian would tell you, is foolhardy and stupid. Just because somebody is biased in their writing, look it. First of all, historians know everybody is biased. No matter who's writing the history, it's biased. You can look at it and say, I know this writer is biased in this way, therefore I can take that into account when I read their writings. But to discount their writings entirely just because they have a bias means that you would have to discount every historical record that we have. Everyone has a bias. Historians use Scripture to verify ancient history. They do. Period. End of story. That's from Bart Ehrman, who is probably the most popular person in this area who's a skeptic, to my New Testament professor at Claremont and all the wackiness in between. They use Holy Scripture as an historical source. So if an atheist tells you, prove that Jesus existed and don't use the Bible, you just simply say, well, nobody does that. Not one single historian that is credible discounts the Bible when it comes to ancient Near Eastern history. Period. End of story. This is where my training at Claremont comes in very handy on this. Because when we talked about ancient Near Eastern history, and that was really my focus, was Christian literature and literature in ancient Near Eastern history. That's what we focused on. We looked at all of this. If we discounted Holy Scripture and Christian writings, you know, whether it be the Nag Hammadi Library, which was Gnostic, from the Coptic Church in Egypt, Alexandria, these sorts of, if we ignored those things, we wouldn't have anything to go on, or very, very little. So to discount something as, you know, biased or whatever, and not take that as something that's supplying you information from ancient history, you might as well forget about doing ancient history. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So using these sources are a legitimate tool for establishing historical fact. This is one thing that Dillahunty doesn't seem to understand. So the point here being that to memorize the minimal facts as put forth by Dillahunty, not according to this obscure website that we don't have the URL for, is to memorize historical facts. And sorry, but as a historian, you have to memorize stuff. You do. You have to memorize dates and names and different things. That's part of the drill. You have to memorize things. If you want to understand historical facts, the first step is memorize it. It really is. I mean, people say, oh, well, we can teach you history and you don't have to memorize. Well, that's nonsense. That's just not true. You have to memorize stuff. And then from there, you gain understanding. Now, you can memorize stuff as you're gaining understanding. That works pretty well. But you do have to memorize. That's just part of doing history.
Jesus died. Two words. Jesus died. The disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. James, the skeptical brother, believed. Paul, the persecutor, believed. And there was an empty tomb. That doesn't give anybody any understanding of the historical facts. Unless they happen to focus on that word in Numbers 2, 3, and 4 of believed.
Okay, so now he's taking this obscure website and he's naming a version of Habermas's minimal facts. Now, again, Habermas has 12 quote-unquote minimal facts in his work. He makes the assertion that 75% of the scholars he surveyed, and by his own admission, the majority of those scholars are skeptical scholars. 75 of those mostly skeptical scholars that he surveyed agree to the 12 minimal facts. He has pared that down to the 6 I named, and those scholars he surveyed at a rate of 95% agree to those 6 facts. This is a distorted version of 4 of the 6 facts that I named, and they add empty tomb. Notice that Dillahunty leaves out what I would consider probably the strongest fact that 95% of the scholars that Habermas surveyed, again, most of which are skeptical, he leaves out the early attestation. Now, where do we get the early attestation? Well, let me explain that one. St. Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. So now, when you're an historian, you really borrow from a lot of other disciplines. So, for instance, it was kind of nice because we did that. That was where the ancient literature discipline really crossed a lot of disciplines. So you got some historical training, you got some higher critic training, you got some lower critic training, and what we would do is look at things like 1 Corinthians, and we would say, okay, let's put a date on this. And we would put a date anywhere from 50 to 52. So secular historians, so take James Crossley. This is really this originally where this came up in our podcast, was James Crossley, who is a secular ancient historian, came on the Unbelievable podcast and talked to Gary Habermas about these minimal facts. Now, James Crossley, as a secular historian, would say, okay, I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. I mean, that's really his interest. He's like, you know, Christianity has really shaped the world as a whole. And he as a historian, is trying to figure out how did that happen. And so he's looking at something like 1 Corinthians, where the resurrection of Christ is probably most strongly attested in 1 Corinthians 15. He looks at that and he says, okay, I'm presented with this idea here, this testimony from this guy who calls himself Paul. First of all, I want to go to biblical scholars and talk about, did this guy Paul tell me the facts surrounding him. He's not a fabricated figure? No, he's not. Okay, did he actually write this? Yes, he actually did. About what date? Let's talk about dates here. So, there's some back and forth and that sort of thing. And you come up with a date about 50, 52, given the circumstances, the telltale signs that are contained within a document like 1 Corinthians. And then you say, okay, now the section in the 15th chapter, or what has been labeled as the 15th chapter, particularly interests me because this sounds like, I don't know, tell me about that. And so the higher critical scholar, and this is where higher criticism, I don't have a ton of use for higher criticism, but here's where it comes in fairly handy, is that higher critics have been able to determine that certain passages of Holy Scripture are what are known as creedal material. In other words, it was material that biblical writers were using in their own works. Now, of course, the works like 1 Corinthians, what is considered authentic Pauline material, But 1 Corinthians 15 is also, by those same scholars, considered to be creedal material, which means it predates the writing. And so, as we look at this, and this is some of the fun stuff we did at Claremont. We look at this and we say, Saint Paul starts this off and says, "What I received, I pass on to you as of first importance." And so we look at that and we say, okay, St. Paul must have received this, maybe not prior to his conversion, but shortly thereafter. This was something that was told to him around the time of his conversion, because of those words. I mean, so we're trying to date this creedal material, because it appears to us as higher critics that obviously this is not original St. Paul material. He's imported this from someplace else. And so we look at it and we say, okay, well, where might he have learned this? And what it talks about is, what I received, I pass on to you as first importance. And it appears that St. Paul received this around the time of his conversion, which would have been maybe 5 to 8 years before 1 Corinthians. So let's just say 5, and let's just say 1 Corinthians was written in AD 52. Give it a later date. AD 52, that would put you at 47. And then you think, okay, if Paul received it then, and this was pretty well-established teaching material for those who called themselves Christians at the time, we can put that anywhere from, let's just say 5 to 10 years prior to when St. Paul repeated this. All right, so we're already at 47. And if we take a conservative estimate, that would put the material at 42. Now, some scholars, and I agree with this, I think it's much earlier. It's somewhere between, I think this creedal material from 1 Corinthians 15 comes somewhere in AD 35, 36. And when Gary Habermas discussed this with James Crossley on the Unbelievable podcast, Crossley had no problem with a dating of 35, 36. He said that seems completely plausible. So, I mean, especially when you're dealing with ancient history, you know, a difference of 5 or 10 years is not a big deal breaker. So if, even if we put the material at 42, most more liberal leaning scholars are going to put Christ's death at, you know, somewhere between 30 and 33. So we're talking less than 10 years or less between when this material, when this attestation was put forth, and the actual event. It's very, very early. You know, Michael Jackson has died within the past 10 years. If somebody came along and said that Michael Jackson has risen from the dead, we could easily prove them wrong, if we had to. God forbid. We could exhume Michael Jackson, do a DNA test, and prove you wrong immediately. Now, we may have some more modern science at our hands, but even within 10 years, if such a claim was made, there would have been someone on hand to disprove it. And presumably, and here's the thing, here's where I want to bring in this idea of speculation. Until somebody comes across with something that definitively debunks something else in ancient history, you have one attestation and one corroborating piece of evidence to establish ancient history. That is a pretty high bar. There's a lot of stuff that we take on faith that has one entry and one piece of corroborating evidence, and we take it as ancient history. And you would be surprised at some of this stuff. I mean, take Socrates, for instance. I mean, this is similar to that. I'm just trying to give a big example here, but Socrates, we don't have any of Socrates' writings at all. The only reason we know about Socrates is because of Plato. Take Plato out of the equation, we've got no Socrates. So Plato testifies as Socrates. We have one or two, maybe, and I don't really know all the history on this off the top of my head, but maybe we have one other attestation outside of Plato that Socrates existed. You put the bar any higher, we've got no Socrates. Okay? This is the kind of level of stuff we're talking about here. So for him to cite this obscure website, leave that piece of information out, you are really gutting Habermas's argument in a huge way. Especially the early attestation piece. See? Yeah. And what, to be fair to Dillahunty, what he's trying to do is put this argument forth is, hey, don't go on some obscure website and memorize something people are telling you to memorize. Agreed. Completely agree. Investigate it for yourself. Look into it. Check out its flaws. See what's going on. Find out where the original source is. See, if you come across something like this on the internet, and it sounds kind of like, hey, you know, yeah, this sounds pretty good, you should look behind it. Find out what's behind it. What are the original sources? Who came up with this idea? Is this something original to them, or are they, you know, or are they passing along somebody else's material? You need to find out about these things. Don't just go to some obscure website and think, oh, here's a really good apologetic approach. I think I'll use it. No, bad idea. Bad idea. Because these five facts to memorize, these first of all, Jesus died is not the fact. Jesus was crucified. Jesus was an historical figure who was crucified by the Roman government. That's the fact. The disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus is not the fact. The fact that Habermas puts forth is Jesus' followers had experiences with him after he died. The third, James the skeptical brother believed. No, James the skeptical brother had experiences. You see what I'm saying? Paul had experiences. Empty tomb is not even a part of it. The church was launched and it's early attested to. Those are the two other facts, see? So going to this website and memorizing what they say memorize will do you very little good. So Dillahunty's giving you good advice. Don't memorize the facts as they stand from this website. However, the problem is, and here's where the sleight of hand comes in, and here's where the major straw man comes in, Dillahunty is going to start arguing against this list as if it was Habermas's.
Because that's a big issue. They also offer five possible theories to explain these facts. The first, Jesus rose. The second, Jesus resuscitated. The third, the disciples lied. The fourth, disciples hallucinated. Or fifth, this is all a church legend. But first of all, you don't have to believe that there's one theory that explains all of the first five. All of those facts could be causally disconnected at the immediate level. For example, you can believe something for different reasons. That you might believe.
Okay, so here's what he's saying is, so take the actual six facts. Jesus was an historical figure who was crucified by the Roman government. There's really no causal. That's just a brute fact. So let's skip that one. Let's go to Jesus' followers had experiences with Jesus after he died. Okay, what could have caused that? That single fact alone, we could explain that as, and this is really the approach that Ehrman takes, and it's legitimate in a sense. Okay, so let's take that fact alone. Now you can explain that a lot of ways. The closest followers of Christ, they were attached to him, they were emotionally involved in this thing, and so when he was crucified, they were so devastated that they started having hallucinations of him risen from the dead. That's given just that one fact could explain it away that way. Then you take St. James, who was Jesus' brother. Now, again, if your brother or sister, your sibling, whatever, claimed to be Jesus Christ, you would call them crazy. And this is basically what St. James did and his brothers. St. John attests to this. But if your brother was executed by lethal injection and then came back from the dead, you might reconsider his claims. However, it could be said that St. James, because he was Christ's brother and he felt guilty about him being crucified, he felt terrible about it, had hallucinations that he had experiences with his dead brother. St. Paul, who was killing people because of this claim that Christ rose from the dead, had a psychological break. And because of that, had hallucinations of Christ. Okay, now, remember what I said at the beginning of the podcast. Historians do not speculate. They do not speculate. That's a lot of speculation there. But the point is Dilhunty's trying to divorce these historical facts from each other. And that's, again, that's just not an historical technique. You don't divorce these things from each other. You have to take them together. They hang together. Jesus was crucified by the Roman government. His followers had experiences. St. Paul had experiences. St. James had experiences. The church was launched. Early attestation. You don't divorce these things because you're going to cripple yourself historically if you do that. If you start divorcing stuff from one another, stuff just becomes very messy very quickly. And so these things hang together. So to explain them separately, historically, it's just not. If you do that, you're going to end up with very little history. If you apply that same standard across the board to ancient history, you're just not going to have a lot to go on, because you can speculate on all kinds of theories on why these individual facts could be explained individually. See. You take facts surrounding one event, and you marshal them to try to you just don't do this. You don't separate the things, because a lot of times when you put these things together, it gives you explanatory value. All right, and if you do this and you apply this across the board consistently, you're going to end up with very little history. You can't do this. It doesn't work that way historically. And on top of that, I mean, just think about this. So for a resurrection to be completely out of the question, you have to have disciples hallucinating. You have to have two very ardent skeptics hallucinating for two different reasons. That's just not. You're speculating. Historically, you're speculating. It's not plausible. Okay. So the idea of breaking these facts apart and explaining them individually doesn't work historically, because what you end up with is really more of a conspiratorial sounding type of explanation than you wished you would have in the first place.
Because they saw the tomb, they might believe because they saw Jesus, they might believe because they heard about it from someone. You're basically saying that because this person became convinced of something, we can be reasonably assured that it's true. That is demonstrably false. Eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, and people believe all sorts of things for bad reasons, including the very method we're appealing to now. There are people who believe the minimal facts approach because they don't understand that it can't do what they say it's going to do.
Okay, so again, I'm not quite tracking with where he's going with that. There's really no appeal. I mean, Habermas doesn't make necessarily an appeal to the supernatural in his argument. He's just saying, these are the facts. Now, if you care to speculate about what might have happened, that might be kind of fun. Let's do that. You know, let's bring in philosophy. Let's bring in this. Let's bring in that. And let's speculate. But at the end of the day, Habermas is just saying, these are the facts that 95% of scholars agree to. The six facts I named. This is what we agree to. What are we going to do with that? What are we going to do with it? That's why I like that movie, Risen. I mean, it's you know, it's kind of not the greatest thing, but in a lot of ways. But the one thing that's really compelling is the soldier that is investigating, you know, where's Christ's body? We have all these rumors. He's risen. The soldier that's doing that saw him dead, and then in the midst of his investigation, saw him alive. Just two two things he saw with his own eyes, and he has to try to reconcile those things. And that's really the only place that Habermas is trying to bring people to. We have these facts. We can speculate. We can talk about what might have happened. See if it's plausible. Or not. Or just take these things as, you know, and move on. That's kind of where he's at. He's not asking anybody to speculate on supernatural or anything else. So, yeah, Dylan Hunting's track here is a little off, in my opinion.
That's a critical error, because in those five that they want us to memorize, we're not really looking at the facts. We're looking at reports about the facts, reports that people believed these facts.
Okay, so that's frustrating, because that's all history is reports about the facts. Your high school, junior high, history textbook is reports about the facts. That's all we have to go on in history, friends. I'm sorry. Nobody can go back and be eyewitnesses. Archaeology does help us with this in some senses, because we do have some hard data we can look at and say, well, it's reported. We heard that this happened. And lo and behold, we have some archaeology that verifies this. Okay. Now, if you look at archaeology, so far, nothing has been produced in archaeology that has disproven Christianity. In fact, most of it has bolstered the argument. But for the most part, when we do history, all we have is reports, right? That's the point I want to make there.
And this injects even more doubt into this, doubt that they avoid by equivocating between X is believed and X is true. Now, this five-point method, not to be confused with the 5 points of Calvinism, the five minimal facts that are offered by this website, is one version of the minimal facts.
But okay, this is not one version of the minimal facts that Habermas would put forth. In fact, I'm quite certain he would be horrified at this version of his minimal facts. Horrified. Because it's a complete misrepresentation of what Habermas puts forth. Remember, I put forth the six. This one only gives five. And they leave out the best argument, which is the early attestation of 1 Corinthians 15. And they add the empty tomb, which is the one that we can throw away and still have a set of facts that can't be explained. Incidentally, well, we'll get to that in a second. I'm not going to spoil that, but there's kind of the big shoe that drops in all this. Let's let Dill Hunty continue.
Habermas and others have offered a 12 minimal fact list. So, how many facts do we need? How do we determine? Have we begun with this idea that 75% of skeptical scholars agree, then we're going to use those facts? Or what if it turned out that 75% of skeptical scholars agreed with the 12 facts that Habermas presents, but somebody's only using 5 of them because they're trying to get to a conclusion that is subtly different? Maybe there's a disagreement on doctrine about once saved, always saved, or something else along those lines, and they need to reach a subtly different conclusion. So instead of using the 12 facts that Habermas presents as being agreed by 75% of skeptical scholars, they're going to use 8 or 4 or 2.
This is another section that's weird, where because the minimal facts have nothing to do with doctrine at all. The minimal facts have to do with history and history surrounding the quote-unquote alleged resurrection of Christ. That's all the minimal facts have to do with. So this, along with the last thing that I mentioned, along with stuff we covered last week, makes me suspicious that Dillahunty is judging a book by its cover. I can't prove that, but I am suspicious. If I were to put worst case scenario on this, he saw minimal facts that prove Christianity or something like that, and he ran with that without actually studying what Habermas has researched and still teaches. So this is weird. Let's say we'll give it best case scenario. Just kind of a weird way to articulate things here.
Let's take a look at the 12 facts that Habermas presents and a little bit about why this 25% of skeptical scholars who don't accept them might not be so easily dismissed as unreasonable.
Okay, so Habermas does not dismiss these scholars as unreasonable. In fact, he says, okay, you know, 75% of you or 25% of you don't agree with a certain set of the facts. And instead of calling them unreasonable, what does Habermas do? What does he do? He says, okay, you don't, let's get it up to 95. That's what he says. He raises the bar and says, let's eliminate all the facts that I've put forth unless 95% of you agree with them. And that's the six I named you before. See? So he's not calling, nobody's calling anybody unreasonable here. That's, yeah, another weird point here.
So there are actually a number of different lists of 12. They're not all the same, as it turns out. Here's one.
As it turns out, Habermas has developed this research over decades. He did it for his PhD work. He continues to refine it. He continues to throw stuff off the list, add stuff to the list. This is what responsible scholars do. This is not a dig on Habermas at all. This is how responsible scholarship works. It continues to study and revise itself according to what is going on.
From Habermas, that we'll go through rather quickly. Number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Number two, he was buried. Number three, his death caused the disciples to despair and lose hope. Number four, the tomb was empty. Number five, the disciples had experiences which they believe were literal appearances of the risen Jesus.
Okay, let me stop right there. First of all, he's named so far, out of five, he's named two of the six that I named first. Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. Number five, I'm not sure where he's getting this, but the wording isn't exactly right in this. The disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances of the risen Jesus. I've never heard Habermas say believed. I've always heard Habermas say the disciples had experiences with Jesus after he died. No believed is inserted in. I've never heard him say that. I just haven't. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he has said that. Maybe he said it and corrected it. I'm not sure. But I've just not heard him say believed. He's very careful with that particular point. The disciples had experiences which his claim is the disciples had experiences with Jesus after he died. That's the claim that 95% of scholars, most of which are skeptical, agree to. Notice how I keep saying most of which are skeptical. Not all the scholars that Habermas surveyed are skeptical. Okay, sorry to break it to you people, my atheist friends. Not all biblical scholars are skeptical. And it's not fair to discount those who aren't skeptical. All of us have our biases. Now, that said, Habermas in many lectures has demonstrated, and in many documents has demonstrated that he's favored the skeptics over this, and they all agree to that fact. I don't think Dillahunty is wording this right. If he is, I'm not sure. I would like to see where he got this list from. He doesn't cite it.
Number six, the disciples were transformed from doubters to bold proclaimers. Number seven, the resurrection was the central message. Number eight, they preached the message of Jesus' resurrection in Jerusalem. Number nine, the church was born and grew.
Okay, that's another fact that 95% of scholars Habermas surveyed, most of which are skeptical, agree to. The church was born and grew. That's not insignificant.
Number 10, Orthodox Jews who believed in Christ made Sunday their primary day of worship. Number 11, James was converted to the faith when he saw the resurrected Jesus.
Again, have not heard Habermas phrase it that way. St. James was converted when he had experiences with Jesus after his death. That's the way I've heard Habermas phrase that. I would like to know where he's getting this list. He doesn't give us a citation, unfortunately.
And number 12, Paul was converted to the faith, and Paul was supposedly an outsider skeptic.
Okay, supposedly an outsider skeptic. No scholar would agree with that statement. St. Paul was real, if you want, and he was not an outsider skeptic. He was a persecutor of the church. Bart Ehrman would not agree with that statement. Supposedly, he was. And he had experiences. And again, Dillahunty leaves out the crucial language here. St. Paul, who was a persecutor of the church, well documented, historically verified, no legitimate, credible historical scholar, unless they're extremely skeptical, disagrees that St. Paul was a persecutor of the church. He participated in murdering Christians for their belief, had experiences with Jesus after his death. That's the language. So I would really like to know where Dillahunty is getting this, because he is distorting. First of all, he pulls up an obscure website and then criticizes that as if it were Habermas's argument. Then he pulls this list up, and trust me when I tell you, I've listened to Habermas a lot, read his stuff, researched it. I know it inside and out. I've not heard him use this language.
So the first question to ask is, what is or isn't accepted as a fact, and by whom? Are all of these facts, and are they all accepted by 75% of scholars, by 90% of scholars, skeptical scholars I'm talking about here? So, fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. I think that the majority of scholars, skeptical and otherwise, would certainly agree that the Bible tells a story that Jesus died by crucifixion, that he was crucified and that he died. Or that most people believe that he died. See, there are some people who advocate for the swoon theory, that Jesus didn't actually die, but he just...
Okay, before we get into all that, no, most skeptical scholars don't agree that it's... Okay, so if Habermas came to scholars and said, there's a story that says that this guy Jesus existed and was crucified, but we're not sure if it's a story or if it's historical fact, he would probably get very little agreement on that. Scholars agree that Jesus was an historical figure crucified by the Roman government. Now we're going to talk swoon theory. You want to talk about conspiracy? Last week, Dillahunty accused Habermas of conspiracy theory forming. Swoon theory is beyond that.
Came really close to death or somehow faked it so that he went off and healed, and that allowed him to come back. I don't necessarily buy into that particular model, but what I do acknowledge is that we know that people come near death. We don't have good reason to think that people can come back from death. And so when we talk about which one is more likely given the available evidence, then I would have to say that the swoon theory at least seems plausible, whereas the model under which Jesus is the Son of God who is died and resurrected by God is something that is wholly outside of experience, that there's no way to confirm and no justification for believing. You can't even demonstrate that the supernatural is possible in an epistemic sense, let alone probable, or calculate how much more likely it is that Jesus was resurrected by a supernatural being than that we were mistaken about whether or not he died. But before we even get to Habermas's first one,
okay, here we go, swoon theory. So, if we're going to posit swoon theory, first of all, you have to grant an empty tomb. This is something that Dillahunty has criticized throughout his critique here. We have to know that not only did a man survive Roman crucifixion, but he had to escape his tomb. You have to have that for swoon theory. Dillahunty says that people have come close to dying and come back from that. We have evidence of that. We've seen that. My response to that would be, produce for me one shred of evidence that anyone ever survived a Roman crucifixion. Oh, and by the way, it survived a Roman crucifixion and then was able to roll a very large stone away. Because if you're going to grant an empty tomb, the only account of the empty tomb we have is one where a very large stone was put in there. And and there were Roman guards around that tomb for that person who survived Roman crucifixion to roll that stone out of the way, defeat the Roman guards, and get out to his disciples. Which, oh, by the way, and then meet his disciples, which made up stories about his resurrection, which no credible historian agrees with. No critical scholar in New Testament, ancient Near Eastern literature, which was my emphasis at Claremont, would say that this stuff was made up, swoon theory or not. Now, David Hume puts forth this concept of, if the miraculous is claimed, here's how we test the miraculous. If what is claimed to be a miracle cannot be explained by something other than a set of events that's even more miraculous than the miracle claimed, then the miracle might be plausible. Hume kind of gave that caveat, might be plausible. So you're telling me that a man, and we have no evidence that anyone ever survived Roman crucifixion. We have no evidence that a man ever rose from the dead. So we're on equal ground there. We have no evidence that a man survived Roman crucifixion. Furthermore, we have no evidence that that such a man who went through Roman crucifixion, who somehow survived, was able to heal to the point where he could roll a large stone out of the way, defeat Roman centurions after all of this ordeal, and then appear before his disciples, and those disciples, instead of going, man, you're in really bad shape, you really been through the ringer, made up a resurrection story. What's more miraculous? The resurrection piece, and again, I'll admit, it's subjective, it is. You have to say, what sounds more miraculous? That God rose a man who claimed to be God from the dead? Or that a man survived Roman crucifixion, rolled a large stone out of the way, defeated two Roman soldiers in his after his attempted crucifixion and rolling the stone out of the way. Seems like you'd be a little tired after all that. I mean, I'm a flatbed truck driver, and I'm tired after tarping a load, let alone undergoing Roman crucifixion and being in a tomb for 3 days, and then rolling a stone away, and then defeating. I mean, that sounds more miraculous to me. And then having the disciples make up a story for which they are all going to be persecuted, and that sounds more miraculous to me than God rose him from the dead. So the notion that, he's mischaracterizing. He's overgeneralizing. He's saying that because people come close to death and survive, therefore it's more plausible that Jesus survived Roman crucifixion, broke out of the tomb, defeated the soldiers, and then convinced his disciples to write a false story about him. Yeah, that doesn't quite fit either. It not only does it not fit, it's not plausible at all. It would be just as miraculous as if Jesus was risen from the dead. So here's the point. Any explanation that you might offer for those six minimal facts that I gave you doesn't fit the facts naturalistically. So go to stolen body idea. That requires just as much of a miracle. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of scared disciples who just had their... And again, you have to grant an empty tomb. You have to grant that there were soldiers there. You have to grant every account surrounding the empty tomb, and that the soldiers got in there, defeated those soldiers, rolled the stone away, and pulled Jesus' body out of there and started proclaiming that he was risen from the dead, and that many, many people around Jerusalem were proclaiming this. That it's just as that claim is just as miraculous. And you just don't have anywhere else to go with naturalistic explanation. There's been offered no other naturalistic explanations. If Dillahunty wanted to be honest in this, he would just say, you know what? This is a good argument. Habermas did his homework on this. And friends, the best we can say about this is we don't know. We can't posit a resurrection, but we certainly can't posit swoon theory. We certainly can't posit stolen body theory. That's nonsense. That has no more credibility than a resurrection does. That's where he should be honest about this, these things, and just say, and just go where James Crossley goes. You know what? I don't know. We don't know. We can't posit a resurrection. Swoon theory's just as bad as resurrection. Stolen body theory's just as bad as resurrection. And we don't have any other naturalistic explanations. That's it. We just don't know. We have a set of facts that we cannot explain. This happens in history, probably more frequently than we're willing to realize. But surrounding this, that's where it's at. And it would be, Dillahunty would be doing his audience a lot more service to just say, look, just don't know. This is a good argument. This one we're just going to have to shrug our shoulders at. And when Christians say resurrection, we're going to say, nope, no, don't know. Don't know. You can't posit resurrection historically. That's their best argument. Unfortunately, Dillahunty misses it. All right, we're going to do more on this next week. I'm going to go through this whole thing because it is crappy. It's really hyper-skeptical, and this is pretty typical of atheists at any rate. See you next week. Don't forget to listen to us on KNNA The Cross and give to the Well Project $50. Let's drill this well, folks. See you next week.
Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. It brings salvation to those who believe. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Tell me I'm a sinner. Christ died for me. I don't want to know about what you did last week on your summer vacation.